This is David Wiley. I'm professor of sociology and director of the African Studies Center at Michigan State University. We're having this interview on February 4th, 2005 with Representative H. Lynn Jondal, who was a candidate in the primary for the Michigan State Senate back in 1970 as a Democratic candidate, and then became a member of the Michigan State House of Representatives for 21 years, 1973 to 94, as a candidate for governor of Michigan. More recently was the transition leader for Governor Granholm's administration in Michigan, and had served before that as executive director of the Michigan Prospect for Renewed Citizenship, has been a representative and worked at the Michigan State University Institute for Public Policy and Research, and has participated in projects of Michigan State on governance and civil society in Ghana and Malawi. Lynn Jondal has been an outstanding legislator, was voted over 10 years by the Michigan Press Corps as Michigan's leading legislator. And when he was in the House of Representatives, beginning in 1972-73, he sponsored and led successful efforts to enact environmental and consumer protection laws, notably Michigan's Mandatory Deposit Act or Bottle Bill, the Sand Dune Protection Act, the Generic Drug Act, Handicapper Civil Rights Act, 12 years chairing the House Taxation Committee, and as well as the House Consumers Committee. His committee assignments were varied, including dealing with the utility regulation, economic development, higher education, education reform, juvenile justice, and death and dying. We're delighted to have Lynn Jondal with us today, and want to talk to him a little bit about the focus on Africa in the state legislature in Michigan, even though all these other topics could be dealt with as well. But Lynn, why don't we start with your personal history? Where did you come from in the United States?
I'm an Iowan. I was born and raised in Iowa, and did my undergraduate work. I got my degree from the University of Iowa. I attended Grinnell College in Iowa for a year and a half prior to running out of money, and then I transferred to the university. Took a bachelor's degree in history, American history, and following that, spent a year working for the then Evangelical and Reformed Church out of their St. Louis office, traveling to campuses as a liaison to campus ministries, student Christian movement throughout the country.
What period was that?
That would have been 1958-59.
Okay.
Period. I graduated from the University of Iowa in 58, and it was the year following that. Then I, in 59, went to Yale Divinity School, from which I graduated as you well know, that was the context in which we encountered each other.
Right.
And finished there in 1962. I went from there to Los Angeles. The United Church of Christ opened its initial campus ministry in Southern California at California State College at Los Angeles, and I became the pastor for that program. And stayed there until 1966 when I moved here to East Lansing. At that time, several denominations had united their campus ministry efforts in a program called the United Campus Christian Fellowship, UCCF, and then later United Ministries in Higher Education. And we were located here. We located a research support project for those ministries. It was not a local program here. This was the national program, the home base, and we wrote and did training and programs for campus ministries around the country.
The we in this case being...
That program was, there were essentially two of us there as program staff. Jack Harrison, a former campus pastor here at Michigan State University, who then shifted over to that national ministry. And I came to join him then for a period of years. And that project lasted till 1972, at which time I went through a debate about whether I'd stay in this community. I had become very involved in the community over that period of time outside of the work I was doing. Largely, when I first came in anti-war activities, I became chair of an entity called Vietnam Summer, which was targeting, trying to raise people's awareness, consciousness about what was happening in our engagement in Vietnam as a country. And then moved into a multi-issue community organization called the Greater Lansing Community Organization. And I chaired that, and we were dealing with everything from children, making available for children gender-neutral books, helping people in public housing organize. We did a study of how the local Lansing State Journal covered racial matters and student unrest and so on. Just a variety of projects. Started a draft counseling program for students who were interested in exploring their options in terms of the draft. And so I'd been involved in those kinds of activities. So when the job ended, the institute was closed, I decided to look for a job here locally. I had previously, before that happened, run for state senate unsuccessfully in a Democratic primary in 1970. And then in 72, I became a candidate for the state house. And there was a no incumbent at the time. That seat had never been held by a Democrat, but two things occurred at that period in our history. One was that 18-year-olds were able to register and vote. The age of voting was dropped to 18.
Right.
And the second was a court decision that allowed students to register and vote wherever they declared their home to be. Mm-hmm. That is, they could register and vote here on campus if that's what they chose to do. Hmm. 1972 was, of course, in the presidential election year, the McGovern candidacy, which was characterized primarily as an anti-war candidacy, that mobilized student registrations to a very high degree. I believe that of those eligible to register and vote here in the East Lansing district area on campus and the surrounding area, somewhere close to 80% of those eligible did actually register. Of those registered, the voter turnout was even a higher percentage when it came figures unlike we've seen recently, but nevertheless at that time, because of the focus primarily, I think, on the war. Plus, it was a new right for students to be able to vote, and obviously to make that choice to do it here. I benefited greatly as a Democrat in a university community from that set of circumstances. I say that because some of us who were involved throughout the issues of sanctions and so on later included Howard Wolpe and Perry Bullard and I. We all came, Howard from Kalamazoo, and he had been on the faculty at Western Michigan University. Perry lived in Ann Arbor, and there, the University of Michigan. We always claimed we were major beneficiaries of the McGovern candidacy, among the few Democrats who felt that we were beneficiaries of that that candidacy.
So then you moved into the legislature there, and then were there for
22 years. Yeah,
22 years. Mm-hmm. Was that a turbulent period, by the way, at Michigan State? And
throughout that period, there was a combination of things that were going on. Certainly, the war in Vietnam was an issue that attracted a lot of attention and on and off campus. You also had here, as you did in universities elsewhere, a good deal of attention to, this whole, what generically was called student unrest. There was the so-called free speech movement, a lot of activity on campuses focused on student rights, student freedom of expression, and so on. So that it was not uncommon for people to be organizing demonstrations that carried on over on the Grand River. There are some famous marches from campus down to the state capitol focused on opposition to the war, sometimes focused specifically and uniquely at this campus on the complicity of the university with Vietnam and the Vietnamese government. The famous poster, I guess, of that was a cover of a magazine called Ramparts Magazine that showed as a Michigan State University clad cheerleader who was I'm blocking her name, but she was the Madam.
Madam New.
New was it? As the cheerleader, but with an MSU sweater and pom poms and, right. And so on. Because MSU had been very involved with support of. CIA funds or
police training
in police training programs for United States efforts in to overthrow the Vietnamese government. So this campus became quite active, and it was kind of a national figure for a while or focus. The community organization and the Vietnam Summer Project. Both included a lot of MSU folks, faculty and students, as well as people in the larger, Greater Lansing area. But yeah, there was a lot of activity, a lot of pretty extensive organizing, and much of it focused on the war activity.
Right, I think that Ngo Dinh Diem in Vietnam, was a research assistant for one of the MSU faculty who specialized on Southeast Asia and edited the Southeast Asian Quarterly here. So there was that. Ironically, one of the results of that is that Michigan State now is one of the few universities that has a clear policy that will not accept research funds for covert research.
Oh, I was not aware.
Several other universities in the state do happily take it, but not MSU, which came directly out of that experience.
Yeah, okay.
You were in the legislature where you were frequently in turbulent discussions as well, including confronting the metal and the glass industries on the bottle bill, as it was so called. When it arose, was the South African issue, was it another major issue, or was this a sort of a marginal theme at the, for the legislature?
It started, I think, as a relatively subdued voice. Or, there was not. I don't recall a specific incident that mobilized legislative support. We had in 72 a number of legislators who were elected that came from background involvement in the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, and so on, and kind of immediately coalesced as allies on a variety of issues. We very quickly were identified and named as the Kitty Caucus in the legislature. And it included a number of members of the Black Caucus, as well as, again, Representative Bullard from Ann Arbor, Representative Wolpe, myself, and others, Representative Hauster, when he was followed as a term.
Who later became the mayor of Lansing for a number
now
of years.
Now is director of the Department of Labor and Economic Development for the state. So almost within days of our being sworn in January of 1973, that group, without a name and without any structure or anything, but that group of us came together in opposing an annual dinner that had been held forever by the optometrists, inviting all legislators, because the dinner was held at the Elks Club in Lansing, and the Elks Club had a historic prohibition on membership from African Americans, and so that became a kind of an immediate introductory coalescing issue for a number of us who objected to that site for that occasion, and so it was kind of laying groundwork for our working relationship,
right.
And certainly for the kinds of things that we might later get involved with. But there was not, I'm trying to suggest there was a sensitivity to the kind of issue we were talking about, given some of the history and background and involvement of these folks. But I don't remember a stimulating incident presentation of the issue as it related to sanctions in South Africa.
Right. I think the kind of the near-term history was that there had been the mobilization of the Southern Africa Liberation Committee starting in 1972 at about the same time, but which led in 77 to one of the first selective buying campaigns of a city council, which was really the first thing that happened in this arena. And that was followed in 78 after a long, complicated struggle and deliberation by Michigan State's Board of Trustees divesting in 78. So then I think just to put the outline on what happened, then in 1980 we get the so-called banking bill, which says that the state of Michigan will not invest its surplus funds. I remember we always laughed at surplus funds. Not that there were any
today.
Yes, which was in fact current accounts in banks which were making loans to South Africa. And then in 1982, 2 years later, the so-called college-university divestiture, which basically was the state saying that for its 30-plus colleges and universities that they should follow the Michigan State 1978 example and not invest in corporations making operating in the Republic of South Africa, which was problematic since so many of the major Michigan corporations were included therein, including Kellogg and the automobile companies, Clark Equipment, Dow Chemical, etc. And then finally, by 1988, 6 years later, the pension fund divestiture bill. So And so there was kind of a building of that, that activity.
There was, David, I think, another piece of what was going on that kind of would indicate a sensitivity to those kinds of issues mm-hmm. on the part of a number of us. I came out of the student Christian movement, which was very active in many of these issues, organizing and setting up relationships on an international scale, with both a focus on race relations, but also relations, foreign interaction with
including Latin America, Middle
Latin
East,
America,
Middle
Africa.
East,
Africa, and so on. And Howard Wolpe, who was from Western Michigan University, has his PhD in African studies.
Right.
I always smile when I think of it. I think his doctorate was African history from MIT, and I never think of MIT as a place for a historian to hang out. But nevertheless.
Right. But he did his research in Nigeria.
Yes. So I'm saying there was some background
right.
of
uh-huh.
a knowledge and awareness on the part of that group of us. I became involved very heavily in an issue of investment of public funds because I, and it came out of my working with I served on a committee of urban affairs that was chaired by formerly Speaker Bill Ryan.
It's an urban affairs committee.
It was at that time in the House, and he asked me to chair a subcommittee on the whole issue of redlining. And the practice of financial institutions not being willing to make loans or insurance companies not being willing to insure residences and cars and so on in urban areas, primarily African-American communities. And so we put together a special committee or a subcommittee of the Urban Affairs Committee, which I chaired, and one of the things we did in coming out of that was institute or introduce legislation for the state regarding prohibitions on investing in companies. Our surplus funds or our fluid funds, in investing them in banks and so on that had redlining practices. And so the device is one we were aware of, or the concept, and had been part of some discussion that went parallel with, in some cases, preceded the South African folk.
I see. Right. Now, you mentioned Virgil
Smith,
you didn't mention Virgil Smith, but
yeah.
And Representative Bullard from Ann Arbor, where the three of you came together, as I remember, and did some planning about the sequencing of these bills. Was there a particular strategy in the order in which they were?
Well, I think there was. I mean, I think we were. Some of these things happen by serendipity, and we try to. By that I mean you take advantage of the time and the moment, and so on. There was a concern, a preliminary concern for how we shape the issue in a way that was least threatening. To a broader constituency of certainly of our colleagues and the broader community. Our hope had been that we could move without creating a great deal of initial opposition, that we wouldn't invite opponents to organize and just kind of try to lay it out as, well, isn't this a logical, appropriate thing to do?
And you didn't announce that you had another bill in your pocket.
Here's a long range plan, and we're going to start slinking in to that. Some self-consciousness about what different ones of us, what our roles would be, and we were very aware that anything we say about policies with other countries would be suggested as, look, you're the Michigan legislature, what is this foreign policy program, and so we wanted a clear connection with Michigan.
Right.
And the university, well, two things. Certainly we wanted the visibility on the issue and the bills. It would make a lot more sense for Black Caucus members, Virgil and others, to be visible on that than for Howard or Perry or me to be visible, just to try to establish the connection. Here's why, there is some particular interest. The activity on the campus and in the communities, cities taking positions, communities across the country, it kind of gave an opening. I mean, it was a logical. There was a focus already there or being articulated, and so on. So we could say it's kind of natural that we would do that. And we were talking about our money. By that I mean the states. We were not at that time getting initially into things like what can banks or businesses or others do.
Right.
So it was at least somewhat thoughtful in that regard.
So Representative Perry Bullard, I believe, was the chair of the banking committee at that time, right?
And
that
may you know, been, I'll take your word on that.
Yeah, I think that was one of the reasons that you chose the banking bill as the first one, because you had a sympathetic chair there.
Well,
that he had calculated that the banks didn't have much to lose in this, that they could quickly agree to this because they had other bigger fish to fry.
There was, in fact. I mean, they were being, at the same time, dealing with interest rates, we also were working on the redlining stuff and so on. So there's certainly, I think, in retrospect, we either wisely or luckily made it difficult to oppose this. Hmm. Because of the anxiety of being looking like one was overreacting on being racist or something in the resistance, I would like to think we're smart about that, and I think to some degree we were, but I suspect there might have been some serendipity in that as mm-hmm. well.
Mm-hmm. On that score, did you nevertheless run into opposition in the House and elsewhere?
Yes. Yeah, there was, but it never became effectively mobilized. It slowed us down at different points, but I mean, it never became, we didn't have the Bankers Association able to go out and put together a coalition of people opposing the legislation. Yes, they would raise questions. The question all the way through, of course, was the question of what is it?
Fiduciary responsibility.
Responsibility, right. Will the investments, will this jeopardize the value of the investments and so on? But there wasn't ever the, a coalition group that effectively mobilized to say, we got to stop this legislation.
There weren't lobbyists. I mean, besides from Goff, who we might get to later, there weren't lobbyists on behalf of the South African regime?
Well, theirs was more subtle in that, you know, there certainly were letters written to legislators, came from officials related to the South African government and so on, but these were not, there was no one on the ground who was, you know, stopping by my office at any rate.
Yeah, I think you weren't a good candidate, perhaps. Yeah. But that's, but that, in fact, they were providing trips for a number of Michigan legislators to South Africa.
I don't know how much that was used, but, you know, there were, I know there were trips offered.
Right, and they were putting out a lot of educational kits on the Happy Bantu in South Africa with maps and film strips and so on in Michigan schools. In fact, there was always amusing. People said that there were more educational materials available for Michigan kids on South Africa than for South African kids in the African schools. So they did have some of that presence. When you in 82, when you come to the college and university divestiture bill, this coming at the time of the Reagan election nationally, and a conservative swing in the United States, did that make for difficulties in this bill, and was that being reflected in any of the lobbying from the companies or the universities and colleges themselves on this matter?
The universities, the administrations of the colleges and universities raised strong opposition, largely based on their autonomy. The question, in Michigan we have a constitutional provision for university autonomy, at least for U of M, MSU and Wayne State, and its specific language in the Constitution, and the universities trying not to argue the merit of the issue did argue quite openly the question of you can't make us do that. That's a policy decision that is uniquely ours. Now, obviously, the university voice was not a unanimous voice in that, you know, obviously trustees as well as students and faculty and so on were very active in pushing the legislation. In fact, I think much of the legwork, certainly in my constituency, the visibility of the issue was university focused or mobilized in people who had come together and made some commitment here. Now they focused on both the trustees and the legislature to lobby. And, you know, again, I'm thinking as we're talking that while I was told about much of the material and so on that came from South Africa and was stimulated that way, it didn't get focused on me, and that would I guess be understandable since I clearly was not. It was on record on the proposals.
So later it was late in the 80s it was actually revealed that a magnate of journalism, Mr. John McGough, who was in your constituency in Williamston, was actually representing the South African government and seeking to buy a newspaper in Washington to have the voice there. But Mr. McGough and his friends did not attempt to lobby you on these issues?
Now, Ms. McGough was a constituent of mine he lived in Williamson. And, you know, as I'm sitting here, I'm trying to think if we have met. There may have been one occasion, and I did a project work with his wife on a museum project, but I don't believe I ever had conversation, although I think we did share some correspondence on the issue of apartheid and the impact. But he, clearly, the focus, when his involvement with the South African government surfaced, there was a very strong voice of condemnation of that popularly, publicly, and so it seems to me, in reflecting on it, that he never and his allies never got in a good position to make a strong case, that the more his involvement became visible, the more helpful it was to us, because people found it so offensive. In fact, as you know better than I, the university had accepted money from his family for a theater project and had decided to put his name on the theater and reverse that, which suggests and took it off, which suggests to me that his, I mean, having gone that far and then reversed it, that there were not strong political consequences perceived by the university at any rate, mm-hmm. In opposition to that.
He didn't have any support in the House. What's interesting, I think, in comparison, is in various other countries like Germany, where you had, in Bavaria, you had strong support amongst the pro-apartheid lobby, amongst some of the politicians. But it seems that in Michigan there wasn't this base of support for those that were supporting the regime.
There were people, the strength of argument against it, and I remember a couple of legislators who articulated it very clearly. They took the strategy of trying to argue why South Africa, there are injustices in all kinds of places, and you know, the communists are doing this, you know, in one country, other countries, there are other problems. So it, I think, was a little more comfortable argument than taking on the issue of apartheid. Again, I think because it's hard to argue for racial apartheid. Then what they did as a tactic was put up amendments to include other countries, or, you know. And our response was, if the support is there, fine. You know, that's not all that offensive to us. Frequently they backed off on some of those because of they started to worry about what would be the implications in other countries and so on. But I didn't sense, and there may be an ability to correct me on this, but I didn't sense, you know, while I knew people arguing against it, I'm trying to think what the final votes were. I think, you know, there was substantial support, yes, and very little opposition by the time we finally came, yeah, to
well, and people did not want their names on,
exactly,
a vote for apartheid.
Yeah.
And so it was all, the struggles were before the vote, I think, right?
Well, they were, and the thing that we had going for us was a network, both of students, but also a faith network that went to many of the churches and denominations and faith.
And some of the unions as well.
Some of the unions picked up on this, and it gave us the ability to reach out throughout the state, so that a legislator who might have no particular interest in this issue would be getting phone calls from people in his or her district indicating an interest in this. And I think that was, you know, a key strength of the effort.
The do you want to say a word about what becomes of the university and college divestiture bill in the end and the court contestation around that?
Well, again, I mean, going back to the autonomy issue, the university has a hard time, as everyone else did, saying, you know, we're for apartheid. So, and it may have been, arguably, you know, just trying to covet and protect the authority of apartheid or the strength of that. You're going to have to help me on some of this. U of M was key in.
And they brought the suit against.
They brought the suit against the state, arguing that the legislature can't prohibit, you know, essentially determine how they're going to handle their resources, their
right.
investment resources. The we had a decision. Interestingly enough, it was tried here initially, I believe, in Ingham County.
In the appellate court, I think.
Wasn't it the appellate court, and then it was moved to the appellate court.
Where Carolyn Stell was judge.
And then, right. And, then. And so you had it was kind of like a local issue here for us because it was tried in a local court. Judge Stell. I'm trying to recreate my mind, and I'm not doing very well. What were the her arguments?
Well, I think it was that they did have the right.
Said we could do it.
Right.
I mean, to make a long story short, said this is and I don't know, I'm wanting to say she used the parallel with civil rights in other cases, you know, that you may have a university with autonomy, but you also have a state civil rights law, and it applies anywhere, you know. But at any rate, the U of M then appealed that. Did it go to the state
Supreme Court?
It did. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how long this took.
A couple of years, I think.
Was it only that? Yeah. You know, before well, again, I'm blocking. I'm trying to come up with the arguments that we used in their decision, and I'm having a hard time.
Well, I think they came back to the narrow issue of does the state have the right to legislate the affairs of the university? And I think that's where it was focused.
But nobody, I mean, it never was a debate on race relations,
right.
But it was this autonomy.
Right. And issue. So it was struck down.
Right.
That one. Right. But it had been a public statement on that. Then in 80, I can't remember the exact date, 83, 84, the middle of the Reagan administration. You decide to take on the pension fund divestiture,
right?
And that was the big one, right?
Well, it's both more money. I mean,
the
more
$4 billion plus,
right.
I think,
at the time, more money as the, from the state perspective. It also got us more deeply into. This whole issue of the fiduciary prudence. Am I saying the phrase right?
It was right.
Yeah. And we developed in our coalition of folks in the legislature. We developed a. I became. In 82 or 83, I became chair of the House Taxation Committee.
Mm-hmm.
Bullard, by this time, had become chair of the Judiciary Committee. So we were chairing, key players were chairing two of the three key committees in the legislature, the other being appropriations. But so we were in key positions, leadership roles. The governor at that time, Governor Blanchard, had appointed Bob Bowman as the state treasurer, and I was working on a daily basis with them because we were dealing with a proposal, another state budget crisis at that time, a proposal for a temporary income tax increase. And so I became chair of the committee at the same time this started to move and so on. So what I'm trying to suggest is we had a set of relationships that meant we needed to be taken seriously in the administration. And much of the opposition, not in public statements always, although there was that, but was really being orchestrated by or articulated by Treasurer Bowman at that time. And we were trying to provide him with as much information, and some good information was being developed. I don't remember the date that the first report on university investments, what had happened to them, came out.
And Michigan State had made profits by its divestiture and reinvesting in different set of stocks.
That it had been a very profitable shift.
Right.
And so we, of course, were trying to use that as much as we could. The officials in the university and elsewhere weren't the ones promoting that, clearly. I mean, that was not their... they didn't go out hoping to find that.
Right. It wasn't the aim of it all.
Right.
But the then you heard, I understand, from a lot of the constituents of the pension fund.
We got
state police and judges.
I think virtually every retiree of state government. And it was, again, the argument of... our pensions are going to be jeopardized. I serve in a district at that time that has a lot of state employees and a lot of retirees, and there was just a lot of mail, phone calls, meetings called to spell out what this would do to people's security, the retirees' security. And that was a very effective mobilization of pressure. I suspect that that's concentrated in particular districts more than others. That there are more state retirees in particular districts. So it wouldn't be quite as dramatic as if it affected private pensions and so on. We were talking about the state pension. But it was critical, in our judgment, that we get the state administrator of the pension, being the treasurer, to come along with us. And so, bit by bit, that was happening. I mean, it was not... with enthusiasm, but it was at least initially. I don't know what Bowman would say today in rehearsing that. He did come to say some very positive things about that policy and so on, but that was slow in coming.
Right. And I think also there was some mobilization of opposition by the companies. You brought Reverend Leon Solomon in, I remember, for some of the testimony that their presence was a liberalizing presence in South Africa, that they had integration in their cafeterias and then in the workplace in a way that other South African companies did not.
One of the things that made it difficult on our side was that it was hard to have a counter voice to a Sullivan. The so-called Sullivan principles had been established, and so Reverend Sullivan could come here and testify before a committee saying, I've been there, I know what's going on, and I've been hands-on, and what we're doing is providing jobs, and over a period of time, this is influencing those businesses to be more responsible and sensitive. And it was hard to put a counter voice to that with the same credibility, as an individual that would have the same credibility. So there were efforts we tried to think, who could we bring, who would be, and it just wasn't anyone that fit that.
There was no black South African voices.
Yeah, that's right.
It's very hard on a state level to involve them.
Right. Yeah. Right. Now we did have clearly the and I started to receive and we were able to use materials from people in South Africa who were saying, no, we repudiate the Sullivan strategy. It is not, we're in it for the long haul, but this is not the way we're going to make the kind of changes that have to be made. Right. And there were some people, I think primarily brought again, probably through the university, with scholars and so on, who were available to confirm that. But nobody with, as I say, the visibility of a Sullivan.
In the end, there was a large demonstration at the Capitol called the Hands Around the Capitol, in which there were busloads of Church of the Black Madonna, Trans-Africa Detroit, and some Ann Arbor, but a lot of East Lansing and the Michigan State people showed up to put their hands around the Capitol and say, pass this bill. Did it make a difference, do you think?
I think it did, in two ways. One of them is that there really was a strong public mobilization around this issue, again, through certainly the base of the African-American churches and in Detroit and other communities where that presence was very important, but more broadly through churches and the activist groups. It's rare in my memory that there was the kind of mobilization in this community I've seen around that as I did around the apartheid issue, and that was people like Frank Beeman and Pat Beeman and others who were just they were working. I think full time on this, and they were fearless, they were aggressive, and they were very visible. I mean, they set it up so that you physically, in entering the Capitol, had to walk by tables with pictures and materials and so on. They were they left no stone unturned in that regard. So I think when people start gathering around the Capitol and circling it, there was an awareness on the part of people of what was actually going on and what the issue was. And the concept of investing your money responsibly it was not like people didn't know what we were talking about. People did, and there was a commitment that was reinforced around the state.
And this was also a period of rising prominence of black clergymen in South Africa, like Archbishop Tutu and Alan Busack, both of whom I met at the time in the 80s. But I'm wondering, you mentioned your church involvement earlier. Was this also something that lent its weight, growing church activity or awareness around these issues of apartheid?
Well, I think in certainly many denominations were throughout the judicatories were on record and were doing sending out materials and so on by this time focused on the issue. You also had a very active campaign that probably Howard Wolpe told you more about in on the national level, not only were the churches and so on active, but you had very much the bringing in of African leaders from Africa to right. appear in Congress and right. and so on, and that had carryover visibility
right.
And reinforcement for those of us working at the state level. So it became, well, in a very real sense, it was a movement kind of a thing. There were the organizations in nationally, internationally, that had manifestations locally within the state, and then just a lot of people who said this makes good sense. Again, I think opposition having a hard time because what you have to argue against it is to say things you don't want to say publicly, and mm-hmm. you know. So I think that helped the debate. And you know, as we talk about the McGough instance, you know, there was no outcry of support for him in the positions that he took.
So in 1986, Wolpe and the Black Caucus in Washington mobilized the passage of the Comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act of 1986 and override the Reagan veto of that. And so still another 2 years before we actually get past the pension bill here in Michigan. And by the way, as well, it's at about the same time the Michigan State University Foundation finally
right.
also decides to go along with the same policy. Do you think you lost votes and campaign contributions over over your role in all of this?
It never was a critical campaign issue in my races. During that period, and nothing I could measure. In fact, it is embarrassing that I would appear at as many doors as possible and many meetings and so on. It didn't come up as an issue. Mm-hmm. It was not. I wasn't aware of suffering any major negative. Now I did get letters and resolutions from some both local business people and organizations, but these were I'm talking about three or four. I'm not talking about any significant. Number and felt no, there was never any time when I felt, boy, that's really an issue that's going to jeopardize me. I mean, it was certainly a heated issue and so on. But I also think people were not surprised at my being there because we did do a lot of work all the way through that. With the groups in this community of educating people about what was going on, so it was not a surprise. I think I would have been in more visible trouble, you know, if I had been a no vote, because of the mobilization that had taken place.
Clearly, in South Africa, there was recognition of the significance of what those of you in the legislature had done in voting more bills of sanction than any other state nationally. And for that reason, the African National Congress then decides to hold their only North American Congress for youth and students to talk about the future of a democratic South Africa here, and you get to speak to that group there, where it seems to me there is a real recognition that it was the Michigan voice had been very pro-democracy in South Africa.
That's always, in political strategy, it's always tough when, you know, on the one hand, you like to say to people in the political debate, we should be taking a leadership role. But it's tough because people want to say, well, what will be the consequences? You know, let's look at somebody who else has done it. If they haven't done it, it's probably because they we shouldn't do it, or you know, there might be negative repercussions. And I think so. I don't remember us featuring, you know, that we're going to be the leaders on this. That was ever part of our you know, parade strategy. But it was again that persistent. Organizing around the issue to get the message out.
What's so interesting about that is that you know this this also reflects a kind of a strong historic focus on Africa in Michigan.
Yes,
starting with G. Menin Williams as the first Kennedy's Assistant Secretary of State for Africa, who goes to Nairobi and says Africa should belong to the Africans. The U.S. was the first new nation. We stand with you in your claim for democracy and freedom. We then have Charles Diggs from Detroit, who founds the Congressional Black Caucus in Washington and is the first black chair of the Africa Subcommittee for some years. And then Wolpe picks up in that same position in the Comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act. So there's a strong train of interest and support that has popped up in the legislature wonderfully as well.
Well, the Black Caucus in the state legislature was very highly mobilized, and I think it was a critical component of what was put together at the state level.
Right. And I know Representative Carolyn Kilpatrick in Washington now, who sits on the subcommittee governing the U.S. State Department, and USAID looks back with pride, she says, on that time when she and Virgil Smith and others in the Michigan Black Caucus could vote for these bills.
Incredible identification within the African-American community with what was going on in South Africa. And I think the degree and profundity of that was very hard for people not a part of that community to appreciate. And it certainly, I even back as recently, although it wasn't that recent, 10 years ago when I ran for governor, or around a period of time when people were talking about you know, the next phase, Mandela's release and so on, these were experiences that were owned and felt and fully in the African American community, and that identification with what was going on in Africa has also been a very strong historic phenomenon.
So did that these positions you took win you some votes in that campaign?
Well, the certainly not enough. in fact, it was a basis of discussion.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. You mentioned the University Christian Movement earlier, out of which came a raft of anti-apartheid and pro-Africa work, the Southern Africa Magazine in New York, the Africa News in Durham, North Carolina, Today's Africa Focus, AllAfrica.com, North American Congress on Latin America. All these sort of spun out of the University Christian Movement, which only existed for about, what, 2 or 3 years?
Yeah.
That was in the late 60s, 67 through 69, something like that, before it voted itself out of existence. What do you think explains this, out of your own experience as well, this kind of focus on Third World, Africa, Asia, Latin America issues that came out of on a kind of a social justice basis at that time?
Well, the University Christian Movement was a major part of its strength and vitality were the folks from a variety of places, but you know, certainly Africa high among them. You probably had within that movement American young people getting a better introduction to what was happening on a global basis, than they could almost anywhere else. Mm-hmm. It was, I mean, there were common exchanges and travel back and forth, but even for those, every time we gathered, there was an international contingency, and no matter whether it was in Cleveland or Detroit or wherever we might be meeting, that presence would be there. And I think that certainly elevated the self-consciousness, the awareness of a commonality, a common agenda.
Good. Well, Lynn John, no pleasure to have you talking to us about this first chapter. Maybe you can come back and talk to us about all the other struggles that over those two decades in the service in the Michigan legislature.
And, I appreciate it. It is interesting to rehearse some of this because we don't often step back and think through what was going on. You're so immediate to getting. Are we ready for tomorrow's vote and things like that? So I really appreciate the conversation.
Well, thank you for the interview and thank you for your years of service to Michigan.
You bet.